From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, all things queer. The story of a trans woman willing to take risks to become who she knew she was.
I think I was just so ready to become the woman that I wanted to be that I just was willing to roll the dice a bit and take my chances.
We check in on what's happening on the ground in Venezuela.
The Venezuelan security forces don't have good training in terms of crowd control and protest control.
And we meet a few strangely queer characters along the way, from paranormal investigators on the border to winter surfers in New York City. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today we're talking queer, and not just in the LGBTQ way, but that is where we start. SB 1062 was an Arizona bill that would have allowed business owners to deny services of any kind to members of the LGBTQ community on the grounds of religious beliefs. It had been called the Jim Crow for gays. Here's what State Representative Demian Klinko, the only openly gay member of the Arizona House of Representatives, said about the bill to his colleagues.
I mean, if this bill passes in my hometown of Tucson, I could walk out of my home and call a taxi cab and they could refuse me service. I could have a medical incident and somebody comes to my home to provide services and I could be refused.
The bill passed the Arizona legislature, but it was vetoed Wednesday night by Governor Jan Brewer. Either way, damage has been done. Members of the LGBTQ community have been given the same message that undocumented immigrants heard from Arizona just 4 years ago. That is, you're not wanted here. So it seems fitting to begin our show by talking to someone who has spent his life fighting for basic civil rights for all. Anthony Romero is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. He's the first openly gay man and Latino to head the ACLU, and he was born and raised in New York City. Anthony Romero, it is just wonderful to have you back on Latino USA.
It's great to be with you, Maria.
The first interview that we did with you for Latino USA was within 48 hours after 9/11 had happened.
Yeah.
And remember. I want to go back and just take a listen to one quick cut from that very emotional interview.
It's true that not everything has been lost, but a lot is at stake. And when we look at what the government has done, just in a very short period of time, we have enacted a new law that allows the government to hold an immigrant for 7 days without charge. And that is a permanent change to our nation's immigration laws.
Anthony, you had just taken the job of leading the ACLU. What was it, the day before?
Yeah, like 9/11? the week before. It gives me goosebumps to hear the interview and to talk to you about it. It's incredible.
Because at that point, Anthony, I now, of course, this many years later, I realized that I was in shock.
Yeah, we all
were.
I
was a journalist in shock.
Yeah.
And you were the one who was calming me and telling me that we needed to remain committed and true to the core values of who we were as an American democracy.
Yeah. Yeah. When you think about what's gone on, right, Maria, over the last 13 years since that week on 9/11, you think about the massive deportations, you think about the detentions, you think about Guantanamo, you think about renditions, you think about drones and torture. It's really an incredible time. And now we're at a point where calmer minds allow us to have a more fuller conversation, where people say, wait a minute here, maybe we went a little too far. Maybe we did overreact in terms of what laws we put in place. I'm not sure I was so calm as you remember it, but maybe I'll take the compliment. I was a little scared, frankly.
And speaking about fear and concern, there was a lot of fear and concern about naming the first openly gay Latino man to run the ACLU. When you think about that, what about the other, where are we now at the other side?
I was 35 years old. I was young. I was experienced, but I didn't really have this level of experience. I had been an upper middle manager at the Ford Foundation, but now I'm in charge of the ACLU. And then a week later, the worst civil liberties crisis hits since the Second World War. And so there were a lot of people who had, some of them were very good, honest questions about, like, oh my God, can he lead us during this most important, tumultuous times? And, you know, there was some code. People were worried a little bit about, you know, am I tough enough? Can I handle the hurly-burly? You know, it's hard to imagine they would have said that to a straight guy. And then you'd show them. You don't really talk about it. You just do it. And I think that's the thing I've learned. It's just do it, and then people get surprised, and they forget.
Amazing progress on gay marriage.
Yeah.
One, I want to know if you ever imagined that it would happen
Never.
So quickly.
Never imagined it would
happen. But on the
other
side, tremendous loss in terms of what's happening vis-a-vis Latinos and immigrants. So it's not so good.
Not so good for the Latino side. I mean, look how cynical it is on comprehensive immigration reform. Let me climb up onto a soapbox for you for a second, right? The Republicans now say that we understand that unless we do comprehensive immigration reform, we might confine ourselves to irrelevance in perpetuity. They know they need a Latino vote to win in national elections, and they do nothing. The Democrats know that the Latino base is their base. And I don't think they've done everything they need to do. Certainly not the administration. And I think ultimately for the Latino community, we just have to stop being so polite and so nice, so appreciative. We got to put the helmet on, the elbows out, and start knocking some people down on the roller derby of politics and get what we deserve, which is a pathway to citizenship.
I've interviewed you several times. I've been very blessed to be able to do that, Anthony, and I always learn something. But there is this one moment that I wanna play from the documentary that played on HBO. It's called The Latino List, and it's you talking about your dad.
When I was a little boy, there was a fashion show to look at the new uniforms at the Catholic school. Put your hands on your waist, pivot, turn. I remember coming home and doing that before my parents. My father got furious. Los hombres no se ponen la mano en la cintura. The men don't put their hands on their waist. So ever since then, you know, shoulders back, arms down.
Anthony, you know, your dad absolutely loved you. But he did say to you, he was like, mijito, you know what? I need you to stand with your shoulders back and don't put your hands on the hip. Don't put your hands on your hips.
Yeah. Yeah, my father was a very typical Puerto Rican guy, but he was very traditional. You know, he didn't like it. I remember I was washing the plates in my one Aunt Jaja's house, and he did not like the idea that I was washing a plate. You know, he was just one of these guys who wanted to make sure that his son was respected in the world. And the way he thought to teach me how to demand my respect was to carry myself a certain way. I think at the end of the day, my father taught me how to carry myself on the inside. He didn't do a very good job of how I carry myself on the outside. I still put my hands on my hips. I still love washing plates. I got to tell you, I have a great dishwasher. But I carry myself with dignity on the inside, Maria. And that's what my pops told me. So.
But the funny thing about it, Anthony, is that, you know, I started my career as a journalist and in college waiting tables. And I think you waited tables, too. And the both of us are like, well, you know what? If this really just goes all to heck, we can just wait tables together.
That would be fun to
I
have
love
you
that.
In my,
I love
in my
that.
Yeah, we can have you in my station. You can take one. I take the tables. You take the bar, and we can serve up some justice.
That sounds good to me, Anthony Romero. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It's my
on
pleasure,
Latino
Maria.
USA.
Be well. Bye bye.
You've probably heard some news about protests in Venezuela that have turned violent, but it's been hard to get accurate information on the ground. So we called Juan Nagel. He's the editor-in-chief of the blog Caracas Chronicles to get a sense of what's going on. So, Juan, you're actually not in Venezuela now. Why not?
No, I'm at the moment in Chile where I'm based, but I go to Venezuela frequently and I keep in touch. And most of my writers in the blog are based locally. So being outside of Venezuela gives me a bit more freedom to write about what's going on in the country.
So what are your reporters on the ground saying about what the mood is like right now?
Well, there's different moods depending on the part of the country or the part of the cities that you're in. Obviously, in heavy Chavista areas, there are fewer protests. But in opposition bastions, like in the middle class neighborhoods in the eastern parts of Caracas, there are constant barricades. There are protests with banging of pots and pans. The authorities are fighting the protests with tear gas in some occasions, in some instances with more violent methods. So it's two decidedly different moods depending on where you are.
This is something that has been developing since the 2013 election, but then it really started escalating in January. So what happened exactly that brought it to this point?
The situation in Venezuela with crime has recently been in the forefront because of a huge crime wave that the country's undergoing that just keeps on growing. And students have begun protesting massively against crimes committed inside college campuses, and the government has repressed those protests. So there's a massive movement of people who think that the government is not solving their day-to-day problems that are joining into this protest. The thing about Venezuela is that it's not really much of a left-right spectrum that you have to look at it. A lot of the view in Venezuela is more about basic freedoms versus a more authoritarian view of the state.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why in the United States we're having a hard time getting a hold on the information, or is it because journalists are having a hard time working on the ground?
I think that the story in Venezuela was more of a low-key kind of Cold War type conflict in which you had a government that was sort of creeping in its authoritarian bent and sort of taking away civil liberties, but doing it in a sort of slowly, or you had an opposition that was more taking it, more lying down and not really protesting against it. Now the situation has poured into the streets, and now the narrative and the requirements for journalists are different because now you have to go to the streets and talk to the protesters and see what's happening and see what the repression is like and see what the whole dynamic is. And part of what's playing out really in the streets of Venezuela is also kind of a power struggle within the opposition between the more radical elements that sort of want to take the fight to the streets versus a more moderate opposition that sort of wants to negotiate and wants to wait for the right time in order to make their voices be heard in a more authoritative way.
So one story that has gotten some traction on international outlets was about the death of the beauty queen, Genesis Carmona. She was shot and killed during a protest in the city of Valencia. Truly very sad, but there have been many other people killed and injured. What kind of numbers are we talking about?
The latest figures that I've seen are about 8 people dead in protests and about 150 people wounded. The Venezuelan security forces don't have good training in terms of crowd control and protest control. You add to that the fact that there's an increased number of weapons in civil society, and also the fact that the government uses paramilitary squads in order to intimidate the opposition a lot of times. The story with the dead beauty queen is not clear where exactly the bullet came from. The government is alleging that it was a bullet from the opposition's own ranks in order to create a victim. I find that hard to believe, but you never know because there's so many different interests at play here. The fact of the matter is that Venezuelans' right to protest peacefully have been severely curtailed, and there's a certain level of fear of going out on the streets and protesting.
Juan, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria.
Juan Nagel is the editor-in-chief of the blog, The Caracas Chronicles. Coming up on Latino USA.
I did do these black market. You know, you knew another trans girl and she told you, oh, well, girl, I get my hormones from this person. You can go there.
A trans woman turns to the streets to get what she needs. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Rajinder Narayan Singh wanted wider hips, larger lips, and bigger breasts. But she couldn't afford to see a professional plastic surgeon. So like a lot of transgender women she knows, she decided to get pumped. That means she got illegal silicone injections done by someone other than a doctor. Pumping is cheaper than going to a professional, but it can come at a much higher cost. Julia Alsop has our story.
I might do a different injection on you today.
Really?
Yes.
This is Rajinder Narayan Singh, Raji for short. She's been seeing Dr. John Martin, a professional plastic surgeon, once a month for the past 7 years to help bring down the swelling in her face.
It's pain, right?
You know. You've been there.
In 2003, Raji got a series of silicone injections in her face, chest, hips, and buttocks. Instead of seeing a doctor, Raji went to the Duchess, a friend of a friend who had pumped a lot of girls in Raji's South Florida trans community.
I hadn't heard anything negative at that time about Duchess.
Raji's 46 and lives in Hollywood, Florida. She strikes me as a strong woman with a big heart. She moved to Miami from Philadelphia in her early 20s. She went out to the gay clubs for a bit, but eventually realized she was looking for something else.
Imagine having these desires, and then when you're looking in the mirror, you're seeing a man look back at you. You're like, oh my God, no, I have to fix this. The feeling becomes so strong that you just have to do it.
So Raji started taking hormones.
I did do these black market. You know, you knew another trans girl and she told you, oh, well, girl, I get my hormones from this person. You can go there.
Raji says her skin became softer, her breasts got bigger. But hormones can only do so much. Not every trans woman gets top surgery. Not every trans woman wants bottom surgery. But if you want it all, vaginal reconstruction, breast augmentation, tracheal shaving, facial feminization, it can add up to about $70,000. That was out of reach for Raji.
I'm a pretty big girl. I'm about 5'11", okay? And I definitely knew that if I wanted to take this seriously and live as a woman, I would need bigger breasts and I'd need a shapelier body. I'd go out in public and, you know, you'd see people kind of look and they'd make a mockery like, oh, you know, it's a boy in a dress.
Raji's been attacked 3 times. The last and worst attack happened in Miami in 2001.
You know, they were calling me these horrible names, freak of nature. And so I went home with a bloody face, 2 black eyes. My lip was completely split. I could actually pull it apart. I laid in that bed that night and I pleaded with God. I said, God, why? Why did I have to be this way?
After the attack, Raji says she felt suicidal for months.
It was after that I started to do the injections.
Statistics are hard to come by, but pumping is a pretty well-known practice for trans women in the States.
I had some of the girls saying, you know, girl, when are you going to go ahead and, you know, get pumped? Like, you know, come on, are you really serious about this?
We involved right now in silicone injection because the girls, they want to get the process so fast and they want to change your body so faster.
This is Ariana Lind. She's the director of trans services at SunServe, a health organization serving LGBTQ people in South Florida.
Silicone injection is the most common and most easy tools to change your body so fast.
Ariana was born in Peru, but moved to the States in 2001 to start her transition. She describes the transgender community in Peru as very underground. To her, America seemed like the best place to live in the open as a trans woman. She ended up in South Florida, a community with a large trans and Latino population. But when she got to Florida and started to transition, she realized things in the States might be tougher than she thought.
Not just a hard time because I'm a transgender. It's a hard time too because I'm immigrant in that moment. I'm a Latina in that moment.
A Latina without papers.
So difficult, you know, just have to go to the emergency room. have a lot of bad experience in the medical. When I go to the hospital and that time I don't change my name, they trying to tell me sir, they trying to tell me my male name and everything.
You know, in the waiting room and hearing the nurses laugh about me, having a doctor come into the room and you just can tell that they're just uncomfortable.
So Raji went where she did feel comfortable. She set up an appointment with the Duchess.
I'm no dummy. I mean, I knew that, you know, there would be some sort of risk by going to get this done black market. But again, I think I was just so ready to become the woman that I wanted to be that I just was willing to roll the dice a bit and take my chances.
For her first session, Raji met the Duchess at a gas station. From there, the Duchess took Raji up to a small two-bedroom apartment. At first, Raji was really happy with how she looked. Guys were flirting with her more, other trans women she knew were complimenting her on her looks. But one day, about 10 months after her first injection, Raji woke up and...
the whole left side of my face felt like a gigantic boil. And it was hurting. It was throbbing. And I remember looking in the mirror and thinking, what the hell is this? Like, what's going on?
Raji's left cheek was completely swollen.
And I started to get scared. And you know that panic feeling, like you're like, oh, crap, like what's going on? What did I do? What did I get myself into?
She tried to ignore it, hoping it would get better. But it didn't. It got worse. Golf ball-sized nodules started to form on both sides of her face. Raji said she walked around like that for about a year, worried about going to the doctor and admitting she had black market injections. Eventually, a friend called Raji up to say she knew a plastic surgeon who would look at Raji's face for free.
I remember sitting in the examining room, and when he walked in, he looked at me and he said, "Sweetie, what did they do to your face?" And I started to cry.
For his part, Dr. Martin says he's seeing more and more cases of bad silicone injections in South Florida. And that means Ariana Lint has her work cut out for her.
Right now I have to tell to the girls, to my sisters, we have programs and you're not by yourself, you're not alone in this society.
Trying to get the word out there that there are safer options than pumping. No one knows exactly what Raji was injected with, but lab results suggest it was the type of silicone you'd use to caulk a bathtub. Since it's loose when injected, the silicone is mixed with Raji's facial tissue, making it impossible to fully remove.
The rest of my body for now is stable, but going forth in the future, who knows what I'm going to have to deal with. But you know, it's scary because someone has passed away from this.
In 2012, a former patient of the Duchess died after the silicone injected into her buttocks turned septic. The Duchess, whose legal name is O'Neill Ron Morris, has an upcoming trial for manslaughter. For Latino USA, I'm Julia Alsop in Hollywood, Florida.
We had production assistance on this story from Julia Duba. Julia Alsop reported this story in collaboration with the Audio Smut podcast. Check them out at www.audiosmut.ca.
Transition stories for transgender people are all different. While Rajinda Naransingh went far and took risks, we're about to hear two transition stories that come from different generations and from very different places. Cristina Herrera began her transition from male to female when she was 16 years old. At the time, Cristina was living in New York City during the height of the AIDS epidemic. She watched as the disease devastated her community. A self-titled trans Latina, Cristina shares her journey from living as a young boy in El Salvador to becoming a strong woman living in New York.
My name is Cristina Herrera, and I am a community organizer. I came to the U.S. when I was 11 years old. I'm originally from El Salvador, and I began to really start to explore who I was, and I wasn't really getting the support that I needed from from family. I was feminine. You know, there were certain things about me. Like, you know, I used to love to cook. I wouldn't play sports. And I used to love to clean. And so, and, you know, and certain things about me, they were like very feminine overall. And so they used to question it. My stepfather, he would ask me, he would be like, are you queer? And back then, the word queer wasn't used in a way that was very, you know, positive. And I would be like, maybe, who knows, possibly. But I couldn't pinpoint it. I couldn't really tell people what it was. And I don't think it was going to really get me anywhere. You know, I couldn't really be like, you know, I was beginning to cross-dress or anything. That wasn't going to be a safe thing to say to family. You know, I was dependent on them. Yeah, I was living in like a suburban area of Los Angeles. Then I moved to the South Bronx, not knowing where I was going. So that was very shocking for me. In the mid-80s, you know, New York was not a very nice place, especially when you're, you know, as someone that's coming in with very little resources. We didn't have a lot of access to services. Like in my case, you know, I didn't know what was being, you know, a transsexual, because, you know, you couldn't suddenly go to a library and look something up like that. You know, there might be repercussions. And so one of my coworkers, you know, he had a trans girlfriend, and, you know, he confided in me that, you know, she was a trans woman and that she was going to be able to help me with my own, you know, medical transition. And she took me, like, you know, to a surgeon in New Jersey who started me in hormones under the age of 18, but back then they didn't really ask for ID. And my aunt discovered that I was taking medications and my breasts were beginning to develop. And so she checked my chest and she felt something different, something growing. And so then she told my mom. And so they were not very happy because, yeah, I guess they were kind of ready to have, like, I guess, like a gay son, nephew. But then it was like, wait a minute, there's more to that. It's not that. So as I began to transition medically, people were beginning to die of AIDS. And so, yeah, it was very scary. And you know, people around me began to get sick. And so, and one of those persons was that friend that introduced me to the life that I, you know, that I'm celebrating. And so other people in my immediate circle, they started to also get sick, and they passed away. You know, it's like you wanted to build community, but at the same time, there was like a constant loss of community and history. And I hear that a lot with the community that I work with. It's like our history is constantly being like erased. We have very few people who are staying around, who are living longer than, you know, than past 40 due to violence or illness are high. So being a trans Latina for me is a sense of overall pride. Pride of the fact that, you know, many of us might cross multiple borders, you know, in search for freedom, in search of safety to make our dreams come true, and we make it. Thinking about my community, you know, like Trans Latina, I associate it with strength.
Cristina still lives in New York. She works at the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center in New York City, and is also the founder of the Trans Latina Network. Go to our website for more on the network. Now, Asher's story. Asher Diaz was born and raised in Ohio to a large and traditional Puerto Rican family. He transitioned from female to male not too long ago when he was in his mid-20s. For Asher, the change brought him closer to the one member of his family he thought would be least likely to support his decision.
My maternal grandfather and I share a pretty strong set of genetics. This shared set of genes is partly my imagination and partly my reality. One of my favorite photos of us is set in the summer of 1986. My grandfather, or Papa Juan as we affectionately call him, cradles me in one arm. His thriving tomato garden, cultivated in the heat of a Midwestern summer, serves as our backdrop. He's beaming with pride at what I like to think is not only the successful product of his green thumb, but also his newest grandbaby. We both have the same tousled dark brown hair, mine fresh with new life and his peppered gray, and are wearing matching white tank tops. The only difference between us is his pair of worn khakis and my diaper. To the casual observer, the photo could be seen as a sweet moment between a grandfather and his grandson. For me, I look at the photo and see not only the tenderness, but that the world has already predetermined my destiny based on what's beneath my diaper. I was born and raised in the country's Rust Belt, Cleveland, Ohio, in the mid-80s to a teen mother struggling with addiction. My grandparents, who had migrated in the early 1950s from Puerto Rico, brought me up in the inner city. As a young child, I'd make a declaration with utmost certainty that left my family baffled. Despite being labeled female on all my birth records and being socialized as such, I was adamant that the doctors had gotten it all wrong. I was a boy, and my name would be Mark. Fast forward a couple decades later, and well, my name isn't Mark. I like to think I've grown from an awkward adolescent girl into a young man who navigates the world with a growing understanding of my complex and intersecting identities. One of those identities happens to be transgender. I had no idea it was possible to live a more authentic life. Transgender. It was a word that didn't even enter my vocabulary until my early 20s, and even then, I'd often hear it in the context of a sensationalized media story or a butt of a late-night joke. Soon it was to become part of my reality and my family's. It took me years to come to the decision to transition from female to male, and when I finally became resolute in my decision to move forward, I was relieved, excited, and overwhelmed with the next steps. In the beginning, my attention turned to the physical process. Online research helped me navigate legalese to change records, make doctor's appointments, and learn what physical changes to anticipate. It was tangible. I could see physical change each day. I could see physical change on documents. My family noticed, too. But online research didn't help as much when it came to navigating how my gender transition would affect my relationships, especially those with my family. While I carefully planned telephone conversations and crafted letters explaining my decision to friends and other relatives, Papa Juan and I never talked about it. There was no coming out in the traditional sense, despite the increasing change in my physical appearance as months passed. Only once did he make mention of it, noting the shifts in my deepening voice, to which I nervously responded, "I'm suffering from a chronic sore throat, Papa." We never discussed it more than that. As more time passed, I anxiously awaited the moment when the blow would come, when he would share with me his disapproval for the choice I had made, and the mere thought of his rejection felt unbearable. But my fears never came to fruition. While I was exploring my own identity, I learned an important lesson about my own assumptions about people and began to realize that despite valid worries, people can and often will surprise you, especially when love is involved. My grandfather's approval was never explicit either, though. It was through small acts of love and kindness that I finally began to recognize his acceptance. Transgender may never be a part of his vocabulary, but he shows his acceptance in other ways. Warm invitations to family gatherings, home-cooked meals, and most recently, buying us matching Argyle sweaters from the men's department for the holiday season. Decades later, and much to his surprise and my own, our wardrobes are still matching.
Asher Diaz currently lives in Chicago, a short distance away from his childhood home. He says he's looking forward to returning this summer and eating his grandfather's homegrown tomatoes once again. Thanks again to Cristina Herrera and Asher Diaz for sharing their stories with us. Gracias, mis queridos. Coming up, queer as in, well, strange. We meet surfers from an unlikely place.
And I remember these two old ladies sitting on a stoop, and they're like, "Hey, look at the surfers." Just like that, in a real thick Brooklyn accent. I was like, only in Brooklyn, only in New York City.
Stay with us on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. As the fight for immigration reform rages on and LGBTQ activists continue to make great strides towards equal rights, one group that doesn't quite fit neatly into either box are LGBTQ immigrants. This is especially true when undocumented LGBTQ immigrants get put into immigration detention. Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario has more.
Imagine being put into solitary confinement for being gay. That is happening right now in the United States. Reporter Erica Sanchez wrote a story about it for Truth Out. That's how she met Eddie.
On the questionnaire, he stated that he was gay. And because of that, they felt that perhaps other, you know, detainees would harass them. And that does happen. However, to put someone in confinement is pretty inhumane.
For safety reasons, she didn't use his last name. Eddie was stopped by a cop for passing a yellow light. Unable to provide a license because he was undocumented, he found himself detained for 61 days. Several of those days were spent in isolation. For Eddie, being in solitary presented a different danger.
He was literally going to go crazy. He had no human contact. He wasn't a criminal. I mean, he was pulled over for, you know, a traffic violation. And they told him that he was put in confinement for his own safety, which is absurd because his mental well-being was compromised as a result of this solitary confinement.
But this isn't the only type of abuse that LGBTQ detainees are facing.
People are not given their HIV medication or their hormone therapy, which is really detrimental to their health. There was a transgender woman, Victoria Arellano. She was Mexican and HIV positive, and because she didn't receive her medication, she died in detention in California.
Sanchez also interviewed Jonathan Perez of the Immigrant Youth Coalition. In 2011, Perez and a friend entered detention voluntarily. It was in response to the recently announced prosecutorial guidelines in cases of deportation. The goal was to unclog the court system by letting immigrants who posed no threat to society apply for work visas instead of prosecuting them in the same manner as you would a high-risk individual. But on the ground, Perez was hearing that the guidelines were being ignored. He wanted proof.
That was our goal, was to get these stories, and folks helped us out. They went around and started gathering people's stories, and we actually were looking for some particular ones so we can highlight.
At the time, it seemed like only the immigrants who fit into a neat little box had any chance of fighting their deportation.
You know, if you're not a quote-unquote dreamer, then you have very little chances. And I think that's what really hit us, is that coming out, it was really hard to help people there because they either weren't here for 10 years or they had criminal record.
Since 2011, things have changed. A little. Perez says that the work done by immigration activists has made it so that people with minor criminal records have a better chance at fighting deportation. But LGBTQ detainees remain a people without a story. Their issues aren't championed by the mainstream LGBTQ movement. And they aren't the face of the immigration battle either. Perez continues to fight. His experience showed him exactly who he was fighting for. To read Erica Sanchez's article, visit our website, latinousa.org. For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
Down on the U.S.-Mexico border, you can't help but feel like you've entered into another world. It's not just the blend of cultures, but it's also the constant presence of law enforcement, Border Patrol, DEA, local police, sheriffs. But there are some things even the best-connected federales can't explain. Latino USA's senior producer, AC Valdez, has more.
You enter this world driving south, southwest, towards the Mexico border. And you encounter a world of sights and sounds, a world of excellent tortillas and blended cultures. Welcome to Laredo, Texas.
My name is Vicky Garcia, or Virginia Garcia, and I am one of the members of Laredo Paranormal Research Society. The majority of the members come from a law enforcement background, and they began the group more than 10 years ago when they were doing riot control training at a local facility.
There were things even they, with their law enforcement connections, weren't able to put together.
And because they have to take photographs and film, they would see a lot of specs and a lot of energy that was captured on film So that sparked a curiosity. And they really enjoyed watching the night sky, and they actually were seeing things that didn't have an explanation. So and then they started to record things that really shouldn't be there. So talking about UFOs, not little green men, but UFOs.
There's one very important thing about Laredo.
Militarization on the border has just been, it's been so common here and it's been increasing that people really take it for granted.
So when you talk UFOs on the border, there's room for rational explanations. Top secret military ops, spy planes.
So what we may be seeing may have an explanation. We just don't, as an average person, we don't know what it is.
Time 10:30 p.m. A triangular flying object was recorded with a third generation night vision monocular camera.
Perhaps the most exciting recent find was the observation in the night sky of a triangular object by the director of the Laredo Paranormal Research Society, Ismael Cuejar, in October of 2011.
And they were videotaping the changes in the moon when a triangular form started to come through. When they went back to take a look at the video, the pattern of movement wasn't normal. I mean, there are things that you hear when you're talking about a plane or a helicopter, but when you don't hear the combustion, when you don't see the red lights that are supposed to be part of a plane, then you start asking, what exactly is it?
But not every mystery is quite so mysterious. Yeah, that's the word, mysterious.
There had been a claim by a homeowner that there was knocking at specific times during the day. There was knocking. So when the team went to investigate, they were recording and they noticed a pattern, and then they looked on the roof and realized it was, I don't know if it was a squirrel or a raccoon or something that was dropping. There's a lot of oak trees around here, dropping acorns.
My name is Paul Mancha. I'm originally from Dario, Texas.
He's from the other paranormal society.
The name of the group is Society of the Paranormal. Right now, there's only four of us. We try to keep it small and original and tight. Too many people is too much of a clutter.
Paul's investigations tend toward the more spiritual side.
One can grow up as a Catholic, one can grow up into Santoismo, one can grow up to all different types of religion point of view that later on, it's like a piece of puzzle to your life.
Through his group's research, he's attempting to reach back in time to put together the past to make sense of his present life. He had a transformational experience.
2 years ago when we were doing investigation there at the Whitehead Museum. It's when we were in a certain area that has more Indian artifacts.
He and his team, filming, recorded a spiritual presence that seemed sinister.
And whatever it was sucking the energy out of us, but at the same time, it was a spiritual or demonic type that we still can't debunk to this day.
Paul warned me that before engaging in this kind of investigation, research and understanding of what you're getting into is vital. He'll be studying up before trying to summon this spirit again. And his caution can only serve to remind us all to be cautious when dealing with the other side, when we're on the border. For Latino USA, I'm AC Valdez.
New York City is known for a lot of things. Bagels, wisecracks, the hustle and bustle, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans. But one thing it's definitely not known for? Surfing. So let's just say I thought it was a bit queer when someone here at the Futuro Media Group suggested we host a surfing event for teens at the Vanderbilt YMCA in Midtown New York City. It turns out some folks in New York do surf. I met three middle-aged surf instructors from the New York Surf School who keep it going. Kevin Cash is used to New Yorkers being surprised by his passion.
I grew up in Bay Ridge in Brooklyn, and when I was a kid, I used to spend my summers in Breezy. And when I'd come back to my neighborhood, you know, all the kids, so what were you doing down there, you know? And I'd say, yeah, you know, I was fishing and, you know, surfing. Surfing? You know, I might as well have said I went to the moon.
Frank Cullen has lived on the West Coast, but finds his hometown of New York City especially convenient for surfing.
I started surfing in the summers in the early 1980s, and I remember coming out of Brooklyn with racks on the top of my car. And again, I lived in San Diego, and in Park Slope, Brooklyn, I was probably closer to the ocean than where I lived in San Diego. And I remember me and a buddy of mine, because he grew up in the neighborhood too that I grew up in, and we both surfed. We were the only two surfers in the neighborhood. And I remember these two old ladies sitting on a stoop, and they're like, hey, look at the surfers. Just like that, in a real thick Brooklyn accent. I was like, only in Brooklyn, only in New York City.
These guys are the real deal. Now, they may not be surfing the 20-foot waves of Hawaii, but that doesn't mean they aren't hardcore. Here's Rich Livesey.
I went surfing yesterday. I put on a heavy 6-millimeter wetsuit. I put on my hood, my gloves, my boots, and I had to walk across ice and snow to get to the ocean. And then I paddled out in the ocean. And the most dangerous thing about the whole ordeal yesterday was when I was coming back and I was all tired, not to slip on the ice and the snow as I was coming off the beach and onto the street.
Before the class started, I noticed Frank doing something unexpected.
Can you just tell me what you're doing right now?
I'm putting up a subway map, and this is going to be a little surprise for the kids. Now, the reason I am putting a subway map up in the gym is to open these young kids' eyes to the fact that they can walk within 2 blocks of where we're standing right now, jump on a subway, and ride for about 60 minutes, 70 minutes, and come up out of that subway and be a block away from a surfing beach.
That beach is Rockaway Beach. Kevin talked to the teens about why Rockaway is so special.
Rockaway is, without a doubt, the most diverse surfing community maybe on the planet. And I don't care how you want to slice it. You want to slice it by gender, there's probably almost as many gals as there are guys. If you want to go by ethnicity, there's every shade of the rainbow. You want to go by sexual orientation, how you identify, everybody is on Rockaway. You know, we're all New Yorkers, you know, so we're kind of used to being crammed on subways together, and we're used to hearing different languages.
Surfing for many New Yorkers is a way of life. So take that, my California surfers.
I'm going to sound like a big hippie or something, you know, but there's a flow to it, man, you know? The waves come in and they go out. It's just like breathing, right? In and out, you know? When you get down there, you're on Rockapulco time, you know? You slow it down a little bit.
Rockapulco time. Yeah, I could get into that. So after teaching the teens and me how to paddle out and pop up, I gave jumping up on the board a try.
Okay, Maria, paddle, paddle, paddle. Let's see.
Wait,
the paddle.
I'm thinking what I gotta do here.
Don't overthink. Let your body do what it knows how to do.
All right.
Paddle, paddle, paddle. Up! Oh!
It was a lot of fun, and the teens really got into it.
And, like, hearing about it in New York, I was like, wow. Like, I can finally do it in New York. Because I thought that I would have to wait till, like, I went away for college or something to actually pick it up.
I want to say thank you to the New York Surf School for hanging out with us on a snowy Wednesday afternoon. And who knows, one of these days you may see this resident New Yorker hanging 10 in Rockapulco. Cowabunga, mi gente! And now, some sabiduría. Emilio Vicente was brought into the United States when he was just 6 years old. His mother led him as he crawled under barbed wire fences. Now he's a student at the University of North Carolina. Gay and still undocumented, Emilio recently made national headlines by running for student body president. He won the general election, but lost in a runoff. For this week, Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, Emilio shares with us what he learned.
Before I became part of the Scottish Latino Initiative, which is a program that I went through, I was doing academically well, but I never had a drive to exceed expectations. I realized that other students like myself who had similar stories were doing amazing work in the community, and I wanted to be one of those amazing students. So I decided to run because I realized that I loved my experience at UNC. It's been an amazing experience. But at the same time, there's always room for improvement. I've always felt that student government has never really actively sought my voice as a student on campus. And ultimately, I decided that I wanted to run because my different experiences across campus gave me a unique set of lenses that would give me the necessary tools to be a successful student body president. One thing that I've learned throughout this process and even before running for student body president is that you should take risks. It's really scary at times to do something new, to do something different, but it's also really rewarding when you don't know what the end goal is. It is disappointing that I didn't win, but I do think that maybe there is a purpose behind me not winning this election. And I think I've made a dent and I've shown other people that immigrants, undocumented students like myself are part of communities and we're actively engaged in those communities. And that's something really rewarding and that I'm really thankful overall for this experience.
Emilio Vicente is an openly gay, undocumented student at the University of North Carolina. Before we wrap up, I just want to acknowledge the loss of a genius musician, Paco de Lucia, the master of flamenco guitar, who passed away this week at the age of 66. De Lucia's incredible technical skill combined with his intense expressive quality of playing helped catapult flamenco music into the mainstream spotlight and solidified his place in history. He'll be missed, but his music will live on. And we share it with you as we wrap up this week's show. Gracias, Paco, por tu música. And for the rest of you, stay weird, queridos y queridas. We love you that way. Our show is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, and Camilo Vargas. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Danielle Gunter and Antonia Cerejido. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. And this week, there are two people who we want to say a special thank you to. Jonathan Wolf started as an intern and then did some beautiful work with us as a producer. We want him to know that he will always be a part of the Latino USA family. We'll miss seeing his crazy hair in our offices. And special thanks to Michael Jones, our longtime audio engineer, who's done so much to make sure our show sounds beautiful, patrolling my P-pops and making sure our reports sound just that much more clear and intense. Gracias, Jonathan and Michael. Additional engineering this week by Brendan Baker. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, from our studios in Harlem, USA. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And you can check out my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima, mi gente.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors.
This is too much fun. I gotta do one of these every week.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. This is NPR.